Hello and welcome to Saga 50 for 50 on Heritage Bites, produced by Heritage Mississauga. 2024 marks the 50th anniversary since the incorporation of the town of Mississauga, Port Credit, and Streetsville to create the city we now know and love. In this special celebration of Mississauga, we invite you to join us as we walk down memory lane with 50 weeks of podcasts recounting incredible moments in this city's rich history. This is Saga 50 for 50.
Hello, and welcome to Saga 50 for 50. My name is Matthew Wilkinson, historian at Heritage Mississauga. Today, we wanted to explore
Mississauga's ABCDs, accidents, blazes, calamities, and disasters. And there are a number of many things like this affect any community, regardless of time. And Mississauga really is no different, but we have stories that are our own and challenges that we face, some on a much broader scale and we are a part of, some specific to this place that we call home today. And so this presentation is going to explore the accidents, blazes, calamities, and disasters that have visited Mississauga historically, Mississauga's ABCDs. The first story in the accident realm is that of an Eastern Flyer, a train accident in 1916. It's one of the oddities, I guess, of local history. When we talk, someone will ask about the train accident, and invariably they're referring to something that happened in 1979. But as a historian's point of humor, sometimes I ask them which one. There have been a few in time. We'll talk about them individually here, but the Eastern Flyer accident in Port Credit took place on March 23rd of 1916 in the evening. It was dark, and this contributed to the accident, the lack of light. At 10:15 p.m., the Eastern Flyer passenger train, which was en route from Toronto to Montreal, on its way via Toronto and across the lakeshore in towards Montreal, it crashed into a stopped coal and freight train 2 kilometers just outside of Port Credit. The Eastern Flyer was a lightly built high-speed passenger train at the time, and plowing into the back end of a stopped freight train loaded with coal, it wasn't a surprise of who got the worst of the accident, and that was the absolute decimation of the Eastern Flyer. At the time of the collision, the Eastern Flyer was estimated to be traveling around 100 kilometers an hour. The engineer in the locomotive of the Eastern Flyer, the engineer Harry Overend, and the fireman W.A. Anderson, who was in the freight train, were killed as a result of the accident. And so you had this challenge of a stopped freight train and a high-speed passenger train making contact on the rails 2 kilometers outside of Port Credit. Part of the challenge was an underestimation of the length of the freight train. It had actually done its job according to the signal. It was to pull off the main line and allow the higher speed passenger train to overtake it. They were sharing the one line. The challenge was when the train pulled off the tracks, it did not get all the way off the tracks. And in the dark light, or the lack of light in the darkness of the evening, 10 p.m., 10:15 p.m. on March 23rd, headlight did not illuminate far enough in advance for the Eastern Flyer to really affect its brakes. And so with very little warning, seeing the train stopped on the tracks ahead of it, engineer Harry Overend applied the brakes to the Eastern Flyer without any success. It was a devastating accident at the time. The coroner's inquest was held by Dr. Sutton out of Cooksville, and they determined that really the cause of it was the station signal in Port Credit mistook the freight train for the flyer and had the freight train stop on the siding, in which it was too long for the siding to accommodate it. Three of the rear cars of the freight train and the caboose remained on the main line, and it was the caboose and the rear cars that the Eastern Flyer struck. the engineer Overend of the Flyer was praised as a hero. He did not bail from the engine. He was applying the brakes with all his might and lost his life in the collision. When his body was found in the wreckage of the locomotive of the Eastern Flyer, his hand was still grasping the brakes, at least according to the newspapers. And so Harry Overend was praised as a hero for significantly slowing down the train to avoid any further loss of life. There were approximately, one report says 16 passengers, another report says 67 passengers. So I'm not really sure if it's 16 or 67, were injured. But the only loss of life on the Eastern Flyer was indeed Harry Overend, the engineer. And of course the fireman from the coal train, the freight train, also lost his life in the accident. Presumably he was in the caboose at the time of the accident. The newspapers don't go into a great amount of detail regarding his fate. So the two casualties of the Eastern Flyer accident in March of 1916. And there we go to the Port Credit train derailment of 1965. And again, this is when we talk train derailments, although we have certainly a big one that we'll get to shortly, 1965 has almost become obscured at it, but there was not something small that took place. That is damaged cars looming over the bridge at the Ontario Street Bridge over the where the railway tracks cross, and that is a freight car toppled onto the roadway below. This was what had happened was November 11th of 1965 at 1:30 in the morning, a westbound CPR freight train passed through an open switch and crashed at full speed into the rear of a slower moving CN freight train right on the here Ontario Street overpass. Freight cars crashed over the bridge, tangled wreckage in a mess quite below. That there wasn't more loss of life was quite significant, probably aided by the fact it was 1:30 in the morning and the transportation was to say the very least, minimum on here Ontario Street where the accident underneath the railway pass on here Ontario Street where the accident occurred. There were two casualties. CPR engineer Joseph Cassidy and CN conductor Jack O'Connell were killed in the accident. The inquest found that the rail switch had malfunctioned, allowing the slow-moving CN train to travel the main line instead of being shunted off to the siding. That unfortunately allowed a slower-moving train in the path of a faster-moving one, which could not stop in time to avoid the collision. The rail line itself was closed for several days, and it was a couple of weeks before the bridge was repaired and the tracks were up and running again. But again, our first train derailment, much smaller scale than 1979, but unfortunately with a loss of life. CPR engineer Joseph Cassidy and CN conductor Jack O'Connell again lost their lives in the Port Credit train derailment of 1965. From there, we'll go to the Malton gas explosion, taking place October 25th of 1969, really the first major emergency faced by the young town of Mississauga. Mississauga had just, the township of Toronto had become the town of Mississauga in 1968. So a year later in 1969, a gas line under the intersection, or roughly under the intersection of Derry and Airport Road, erupted. 9 stores, several houses, 46 cars and trucks all destroyed. 22 people injured and sadly one casualty, Jean Perigo, age 75, was killed when her house collapsed upon her. Because of the nature of the fire and the one descriptor called it a roaring beast, the ruptured gas line was quite some time before they were able to turn the gas off, and the firefighters were unable to get close enough to the scene to really battle the fire itself until the gas itself was able to be diminished. The initial objective for firefighters was to contain the fire from spreading, but they had to wait until the gas line itself, and it was a gas main, a dead end a trunk of off a gas main that had its pressure valve had failed and it caused the rupture again, roughly under the intersection of what is the Airport Dairy and Airport Roads today in Malton. The fire itself lasted for about 4.5 hours. Absolutely intense heat. There are pictures of melted car wheels and steering wheels and the like, and just the absolute heat. The generator from the fire was enormous. You can see in the picture here, those are firefighters hiding behind what looks to be a utility box as they try to get as close as they can to try and battle the fire. Coroner's inquest due to the death of Jean Perrigo was held in February of 1979, and it found that a wrong supply valve had been switched, putting too much pressure on a dead-end pipe, a pipe that was intended to extend northwards as Malton grew, unless there's a wrong fitting that was in place and the pressure valve could not contain the pressure and finally released. It really destroyed Malton's historic four corners. So if you go to the intersection of Deering Airport Roads today, it is completely rebuilt after the 1969 gas explosion. From there we go to another accident. This was the Air Canada Flight 621 of 1970. July 5th of 1970, an Air Canada Douglas DC-8 flying from Montreal to Toronto and eventually to Los Angeles. What was cited as a pilot error in deploying the spoilers to slow down the plane on landing at Pearson. The plane hit the runway hard, breaking off the number 4 engine. The pilots did not notice that the engine had broken off, and due to the hard impact, they regained altitude for another go-around. Unfortunately, with the broken engine, which the pilots were not aware of at the time, there was trailing fuel, and this trail of fuel ignited as the plane circled the airport for a second go-around. What had happened was once they were airborne again, they realized that there was an engine problem with number 4. They cut engine 4. Unfortunately, the fuel cell ruptured and exploded, destroying part of the wing of the aircraft, making it unable to flight. As they tried to power it to come around for a landing, they're struggling to control the plane, and ultimately they do not. One of the last words on the flight recorder was the co-pilot to the pilot saying, "Sorry, Pete." Unfortunately, the airplane itself, within a matter of seconds, from hitting the runway to regaining altitude to ultimately crashing north of the airport, was approximately 19 seconds. Devastation on the landscape. After 2 minutes after striking the runway, 19 seconds before impact, part of the right wing exploded. Second explosion destroyed engine number 3. Third explosion destroyed most of the right wing as the fuel ignited. The plane hit the ground at 220 knots. All 100 passengers and 8 crew were killed. A board of inquiry determined that a pilot error was the ultimate cause of plane crash again, deploying the spoilers too early on landing, dropping the speed of the aircraft to the point where it had a hard impact on the tarmac prior to attempting to regain altitude and to go around for a second flight, a second landing attempt. There's a close-up of the crash site, which itself is in Brampton today, just north of the Mississauga border. And the crash site is remembered on the ground today with a park feature commemorating the 100 passengers and 8 crew who lost their lives in 1970 with the crash of Air Canada's DC-8. Staying with the aircraft as well, Air Canada Flight 189 in 1978. This accident took place on June 26th of 1978, and the problem actually was not with the aircraft being airborne. It was during takeoff, with the plane taxiing down the runway, attempting to gain speed for takeoff, a tire burst. The pilot attempted to apply the brakes to abort the takeoff. At the time, the plane was about 2/3 down the runway, traveling at 154 knots. The plane could not stop before the end of the runway. It went off the runway, skidded through a barrier, down an embankment, and ultimately ended up at the bottom of a ravine. This is something that we'll play again in the story of the airport as well. So Flight 189, the plane ultimately broke into three parts. Two of the 107 passengers and crew were killed, just due to the jostling and the impact of the crash as it came down the embankment. A number of causes were identified, including an insufficient overshoot zone at the end of the runway, and of course the presence of the ravine itself did not help. There was no kind of not a large enough space for error if an abort had to overshoot the runway, and this again would not be rectified and came to be a focus again in 2005. That very same overshoot. Air Canada Flight 189, a 1978, an attempted abort of a takeoff, ended up with the plane crashing down a ravine, and two of 107 passengers and crew being killed in that accident. Mississauga train derailment of 1979, I've always already made a couple of references to it. Arguably our most significant chapter in the story of what is the city of Mississauga. The derailment itself took place on November 10th, 1979, 11:56 p.m. CP train 54, having just crossed the Burnthorpe Road level crossing at the time, car 23 lost a axle and a wheel, crashing into a residential backyard, but the train itself, with one car having a damaged and dangling undercarriage, continued on down the railway tracks, ultimately derailing at the Mavis Road level crossing, and car 23 came off the tracks, and the next 22 cars followed it, ending up in a massive fireball of an explosion. We will do another presentation at a later date on the subject in itself. Needless to say, this was an enormous challenge for the emergency responders, the first major test of the Peel Emergency Response Plan. 11:58, the first police are on site, 12:01 CP rail is identified, 12:04 fire crews arrive on site, and they stayed. The fire crews were on site for days. This is something that was not easily quenched, if you will. At 3:21 a.m., in the midst of a burning wreckage, a chlorine car is identified, and very quickly evacuation orders are presented and effected throughout the city, ultimately evacuating approximately 240,000 residents. At the time, the largest peacetime evacuation in North American history. Mass evacuation, the city was closed until further notice, as the newspaper headline said, referred to by many as the Mississauga miracle because the massive scale of the evacuation from a local perspective and absolutely no loss of life, and that is the miracle indeed. It really put Mississauga on the international map. It started to, people started to use the word of the city in headlines and federal parliament and beyond. They even issued t-shirts afterwards, and so really probably the biggest singular chapter in the history and the story of Mississauga, something specific to Mississauga, and that being the Mississauga train derailment of November of 1979. Air France Flight 358 in 2005, much similar to the one we talked about just previously in 1978. This one took place on August 2nd of 2005 at 4 o'clock in the afternoon from a Paris to Toronto route. It was an Airbus 340 that overshot runway 24 left. The plane itself overshot the runway, crashed through a security fence, was unable to brake in time, and crashed down a ravine just adjacent to the Etobicoke Creek. Amazingly, a miracle in itself, 297 passengers and 12 crew all survived, some with obviously bumps and bruises and injuries, but it really was almost a repeat of the 1979 crash, right to the site itself, overshot a runway and down the embankment. After the plane had crashed and passengers evacuated, it did catch fire. There were 12 major injuries, no fatalities, highly visible from the 401. They cited poor weather and poor visibility, including a wet tarmac. It was stormy and rainy. And there was also the pilots delayed in deploying the thrust reverser. So almost the opposite initial cause from the previous accident that deployed an earlier one that was the crash that deployed them too early. This one deployed too late, so it was unable to break in time. Thankfully, again, no loss of life. From there, we'll go into our blazes category, and we'll look at some of the significant fires that swept through through our community. The Cooksville conflagration, as we come to call it, in 1852. Historically, many buildings were built of wood, and fires were an ever-present threat, and we have countless examples of fires. We're only going to touch on a few of them in this presentation. But on May 26th of 1852, fire started in John Belcher's blacksmith shop in Ford, Forge in Cooksville. He was on the north side of Dundas Street, between Cook Street and here, Ontario. All in all, by the time the fire was over, 35 houses and businesses lost, 16 barns, 4 stables, and the old town hall, or Retrobites Hall as it was known, was also lost in the fire, and very little of the core of the village around the intersection of Dundas Street and here in Ontario survived. One of the lone remaining hallmarks that echo back to that time is a building that was built immediately after the fire. After the first general store was lost, a second general store was built, and that building survives today. That is the 1852 Copeland General Store, as it was known, now a Minimart at the corner of Dundas Street, at the south east corner of Dundas Street in here, Ontario. You can still see the 1852 General Store, built out of the ashes of the Great Fire of 1852. The Derry West Fire of 1867. If Mississauga had something that was, had a place within it that was dreaming of bigger things, of growing, and Derry West was certainly it. When it came time to apply to become the county seat for Peel County in the 1850s, there were several applicants, including Streetsville and Brampton, who ultimately got it, Malton and Derry West. And the question being, you know, what on earth did Derry West have anything to do with that conversation? It's certainly disappeared from our landscape today. Well, if it weren't for a fire in 1867, a very scarcely covered fire in terms of the news, we might well be living in the community of Derry West today rather than Mississauga. It's all rose-colored glasses of history. We're never quite sure the way things might have worked. But Derry West certainly was on the prime example of being primed to expand as a community. Unfortunately, with the being swept by fire in 1867, much of the crossroads village of Derry West was lost, and very, very little was rebuilt. Churches, hotels, houses, a schoolhouse, etc., they were all lost in a fire. Derry West itself was located around the intersection of Derry Road and here on Ontario Street. Reportedly, that two women died in the loss of the Browns Hotel during the fire as well. So Derry West struck by fire in 1867, and very, very little of it remained or was rebuilt after the fire itself. The Globe Hotel fire in Streetsville in 1876. The Globe Hotel in the historic picture here is the big hotel on the left of that picture. September 6th of 1876, fire started in the hayloft in the stables behind the Telegraph Hotel. Both the Globe and the Telegraph were lost, as were several adjacent buildings. There was loss of life, including the son of the founder of Streetsville, Timothy Street Jr., lost his life in the fire. May have actually been the cause of the fire, but he lost his life in the fire. It was said that the fire could have been much worse. It might have actually swept through the village of Streetsville at the time. But it started to rain, and rained quite heavily, and that put an end to the fire. Alcohol, excessive drinking, and a careless match were said to blame for the setting the hay on fire. Again, with loss of life and a great deal of Streetsville in 1876. Also in Streetsville, a few decades later, June 29th of 1909, fire broke out in the Graydon General Store in Streetsville, referred to as the Graydon Fire. It destroyed several buildings on the west side of Queen Street in downtown Streetsville. And the loss of the Graydon store, but the adjacent Graydon house, claimed four members of the Graydon family. The Great Arundel Fire, one of the fires that really put its stamp on the history of the community. May 6th of 1919, a carelessly dropped match into a kerosene bucket, accidental as it was, set the Barker General Store ablaze. There were strong winds coming out of the north, out of the valley. It flamed the fire, causing it to spread both to the east and to the south. Although many firefighters, including Cooksville and Port Credit firefighters, came out to try to fight the fire, it proved to be a most difficult and stubborn fire to try and contain. By the time it was out, the fire consumed 14 buildings in the middle of the village. Most of it was never rebuilt, and arguably the village never truly recovered from the fire itself. One of the buildings survived was a mill building built of stone, and that was the line the fire shall not cross. As the firefighters fought it, they used the stone of the building and watered down the roof to kind of create a block for the fire, and they were successful in having the fire halt at that building. Unfortunately, that building itself, Brown Cider Mill, burned 4 years later itself, and so that building is also gone to this day. So most of Arundel was lost in the fire itself, again, starting at the Barker General Store Post Office, and right next door to the Royal Exchange Hotel, a 100-year-old building, famous hotel, was also consumed and lost by the fire. Into Streetsville again, the Streetsville Mill Fire of 1929. If you ever look at the Mississauga coat of arms, you'll find a mill wheel, a cog wheel on the coat of arms. And that reference is taken from the Streetsville coat of arms, which are also depicted in mill wheel. And it's really the backbone of the historic foundation of that community was the milling along the Credit River, and particularly that of Timothy Street's mill. There are multiple owners to the mill over time, Timothy Street being the founder of the mill, but others, including Drakus and Johnson, also operated the mill, and the Blaines operated the same mill over time. The loss of the mill, September of 1929, the mill was located at the foot of Mill Street in Streetsville, and the loss of the mill itself was a blow to the economy of the community, and really the end of an era, the ending of the milling within the confines of the village proper. And the fire is kind of a sad, stark reminder, kind of this loss of a building. Despite the best efforts to fight the fire, they just could not. There were 50,000 bushels of grain in the building itself, and that just contributed to the spread of the ferocious blaze that consumed the building in September of 1929. Hand fireworks explosions in 1942 and 43 on Cawthra Road north of Dundas Street was the original location of the Hands Fireworks Company. January 31st of 1942, the powder room exploded. This is Hands Fireworks in 1942, or during the Second World War, focused their energies on wartime productions for munitions using their facilities that were generally dedicated for fireworks. Again, January 31st of 42, the powder room exploded, and fire consumed the main factory buildings. One employee was killed. His name was Jack Dickinson. July 6th of 1943, a second fire on the property in the mixing plant claimed the life of one employee, a young lady by the name of Norma Krantz. Local evacuations were in place, and a great deal of fear that companies involved in wartime production were in danger of espionage. No example of that actually being the case here, but there was a worry about it. The factory on Cawthorne Road finally closed in 1964. The Texaco refinery fire of 1978. October 2nd, 1978, the Texaco refinery in Port Credit, an oil storage, two oil storage tanks, north of the railway tracks, north of the village proper, were involved in major fire and local evacuation. 1,000 people evacuated. Several local explosions. The fire itself burned for 2 days. It was determined that the cause was arson, and they identified a former employee, Thomas Coxhead, who was arrested, found guilty, and sentenced to 10 years in prison as a result of, he was a disgruntled former employee of the refinery. Into our calamities section that affected our community, and this is something that is, very compelling to us today, and considering what we're going through with COVID-19. Cholera is an epidemic that came through our community on multiple occasions. You can see the dates there. It was kind of a repeat offender, if you will. Early on, there's a 30 to 40% casualty rate for those afflicted. There are several mass graves in some of our historic cemeteries around Mississauga connecting to this time of these times of cholera. Doctors were really unable to halt the progress. The disease itself was highly contagious and not very well understood. Those things kind of sound familiar today as well. We're talking about our current challenges with coronavirus and the like. We have examples in cemeteries where if you read the dates on cemetery stones, you realize the mass casualties and even single families wiped out as a result of cholera at different times. There are other early epidemics that affect our community. Diphtheria is probably one of the deadliest. Highly contagious, about 20 to 30% mortality rate, depending on the statistics themselves. We have some families succumbing in great number within short periods of time. And again, gravestones in a way are the cheat sheets of history. You can really look at the dates of family members and start to pick out the early casualties in mass, particularly of children. Beloved local doctor, after whom Dixie wrote his name, Dr. Beaumont Wilson Bowen Dixie, sadly lost four of his children in the 1853 diphtheria epidemic. And if you go to St. Peter's Anglican Cemetery, you can find Dr. Dixie's big stone in the foreground and then the four crosses for his four children who lost their lives in diphtheria. Sadly, quite possibly diphtheria that was brought home by their father as he treated the ill in his community to the best of his ability. Absolutely beloved local doctor, and that's a story for another time. There were 32 documented cases in 1896 with 18 fatalities. So again, even as the century progressed, still a very deadly disease within our midst. Spanish flu, something we may have read more about in recent months than many of us maybe even thought we ever would or even ever heard of. There's an old saying, if you don't know your past, you're doomed to repeat it. We can draw strong parallels between what we're dealing with now in COVID-19 and the Spanish flu of 1918 and 1920. Right down to the public notices, and this is you could easily put this notice in a window today and think we're talking about COVID, but here is Dr. McFadden, medical health officer in Streetsville, issuing this warning, if you will, to prohibit all gatherings of any public character in churches, schools, public libraries, lodges, moving picture theater, pool rooms, bowling alleys, and any other place of amusement in the municipality of Streetsville until further notice. Really gained on trying to control the deadly spread of the Spanish flu. There was a high mortality rate at the time of the Spanish flu. There was no local hospital. The Peel Memorial Hospital in Brantford is born out of these times. There are 600 deaths in Peel County attributed to the flu, although exact numbers are uncertain. Some of the reporting is not well known. About 30,000 Canadians died during the Spanish flu epidemic, so it came in waves. And 25 million died over a worldwide estimated 5% of the global population, with a mortality rate around 20%. So this was, without a doubt, the deadliest pandemic ever to sweep the planet in modern times, in recorded times, that is. However, we are sharing a great deal of similarities with the challenges we currently face with COVID-19. And we'd be well remembered to think back on the times 100 years ago when we were faced by many of the same challenges, and how that defined a generation and how they responded to it is something well worth remembering and exploring. Into the disasters that affected our community now, the D's and the ABCDs. The 1791 hurricane, that seems like ancient history, and it truly, truly is. There's very little recorded or well known about the 1791 hurricane other than when it occurred. It was said that the devastation that was wrought in 1791 was still evident on the ground in the 1806 survey by Samuel Wilmot. And there's a map of Samuel Wilmot you'll see stretching across the Credit River Valley. There you'll see the word windfall, and this is denoting the path of a major storm that wiped out the forest stands in the lower Credit River Valley. Indigenous Mississaugas believed that the water spirit Menudo had departed in anger due to increasing presence of non-native settlers. However, the storm itself was documented having struck the shores along Lake Ontario. A lot of damage, some of the early notes talk about a landscape that was stripped barren. So we're dealing with a massive storm that had come through in a forested area and wrecked absolute havoc that 20 years later when the surveyors are coming through, or sorry, 10 years later when the surveyors are coming through, you still see, they still saw a great deal of the devastation that had taken place a few years prior. The flood of 1875, sorry, late spring, late long-lasting winter compounded by a volcanic eruption that adjusted worldwide temperatures at the time and left the solid winter freeze through April, and then into the end of April, a sudden thaw with tremendous rainfall, swelling the size of the water, and some water control, early water control dams and mill dams upstream collapsed in time, basically creating a rush of water that came down at high speeds through the Credit River Valley, massive flooding in the lower valley. The Credit River and Port Credit hit particularly hard. The flooding, the water did not recede for weeks. It was an enormous flood. This year, in 1875, was a year of drought, a year of famine, cool summer, poor crops, poor fishing, absolutely difficult year all around, largely attributed again to the climate change brought on by the volcanic eruption in Iceland. But the flood of 1875, and that's a picture that an artist's rendition of a wrecked schooner called the Enterprise was shown as one of the wrecks as a result of the flood of 1875. The cyclone of 1923, June 24th of 1923, referred to as a cyclone, but it really was a tornado, touched down near Hornby in Halton, not too far out of Milton, and traveled 20 kilometers in 25 minutes, largely on the ground for its entire time, damaged many buildings. Cooksville hit particularly hard, Cooksville United Church heavily damaged, as was the Cooksville Brickyard. Three deaths were attributed to people in the Cooksville area being hit by flying debris. And so the cyclone or the tornado of 1923 did tremendous damage, along its path. And again, it was on the ground for nearly 25 minutes. What a horrendous thing to have lived through in 1923. The Arendelle Dam burst in 1935. We think of the Credit River really as kind of a passive recreational river today, but we forget that it is a powerful river that has been used for hydroelectricity generation, for milling purposes and the like. A concrete and earthen dam was created across the Credit River Valley to north of Dundas Street to provide a head pond for a hydro generation project in the 19-teens. There was a spring flood higher upstream, and it caused another dam a little further upstream to fail, and that created a wall of water that rushed down the Credit River Valley, impacting the dam at Arendelle and causing the central section of the dam to topple out, and a wall of water from the what was dubbed Lake Arendelle came crashing over, flooding the lower valley and wiping out the Dundas Street Bridge. The road and bridge were closed for more than eight months as the entire section was elevated and new bridge installed. And we can see the results of that elevation today in the way that the parkland on either side of Dundas Street, which is essentially now a causeway, with a change elevation, has raised the bridge out of direct threat of another flood like that ever occurring. The biggest storm we ever faced to date was undoubtedly Hurricane Hazel in 1954. The headline of the Toronto Sun of October 14th of 1954 said, "There will be rain tonight." Oops, they didn't quite get that one right. October 15th of 1954, a hurricane over the Atlantic seaboard coming up the eastern coast of the United States was pulled inland by a low pressure system. It made water across over the Allegheny Mountains. The weather system made waterfall again on Lake Ontario, intensified in its ferocity, and made landfall ground zero at the Humber River. And it just moved inland a little bit and then sat there and drenched and pelted Toronto and historic Mississauga and as far up as the Holland Marsh, and it just devastated the communities there, and the flooding was enormous. 300 millimeters of rain fell in 48 hours. 81 people killed and a tremendous loss of personal property. The dams along the Credit River, again, it made landfall on the Humber River, but with the amount of rain that fell, the rivers like the Credit River and the Etobicoke Creek absolutely burst their banks and altered the landscape of their river course, of their systems. The Category 4 hurricane with highest winds at 155 kilometers an hour, again, it caused 300 millimeters of rain in 48 hours, caused massive local flooding. Dams were burst, were overwhelmed, where the river found a way around the dams. The flooding was intense. One of the reports at the time said Lakeview, Mississauga Lakeview, was swallowed by the lake between the Etobicoke Creek bursting its banks and the flood coming in, the headwaters coming in from Lake Ontario, absolutely inundated the historic shoreline of Mississauga. Conservation and flood water measures adopted as a result, including the Credit Valley Conservation Authority, is born out of moments like these. The Meadowvale tornado of 1985, an F1 tornado hit the Meadowvale area of Mississauga, causing over $800,000 of damage, significant local flooding and service disruption. There are two houses destroyed and a historic house known as Forster House, which is now home to Heritage House Dental. Its roof was torn off as a result of the tornado, and it's replaced. You can see that line within the brick today if you visit Heritage House Dental, the former Forster House, and you can see where the roof has been repaired. A scar or remembrance, if you will, from the 1985 Meadowvale tornado. And that's the end of our presentation for today.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Saga 50 for 50.
There's lots more to talk about on this, but this is just a kind of a tidbit or a look at a different type of history within our community and ways in which we can explore in different ways the fascinating place and the fascinating story that is part of the city of Mississauga today. So thank you so much. I'm Matthew Wilkinson, historian with Heritage Mississauga. We look forward to seeing you again.
We hope you enjoyed this week's installment of Saga 50 for 50. Help us keep celebrating the 50th anniversary of the city of Mississauga by following Heritage Bites wherever you get your podcasts. Also, be sure to check out Heritage Mississauga on all our social media platforms and follow hashtag Saga 50 for 50 to stay up to date on all of Mississauga's 50th anniversary celebrations. This is Heritage Mississauga signing off. Until next time.